All right, I'm going to tell y'all how I like to use one of my favorite tools out in the woods, and that is the tracker from Onyx Hunt. So here's how I've been using it lately. I got this new property I'm going to be hunting this year, and the very first thing I did on the property was I went out and I drove all of the roads that are drivable in my truck, and I had the tracker on as I was driving around. So after I got done driving around, I selected the track on my app and changed it to where it's just a solid black line. So now I've got a really nice, easy to see roadmap of everywhere that's drivable in a truck on the property. So here's what that does for me so far. Now I've got an easy to read map of everywhere that you can drive in a truck on the property. But also that roadmap is actually very useful because it makes it very easy for me to see what roads are drivable and what parts of the property are most accessible and what parts of the property are least accessible. Like I said, one of my favorite tools. If you're not using it already, you should be. And if you want to give Onyx a try, go get an Elite membership and use the promo code Southern at checkout. That's going to save you 20% and it's going to help the show out. Know where you stand with Onyx Hunt. If you hunt deer out of trees, you need to go check out latitudeoutdoors.com. They got a little something for everybody, whether you're a saddle guy or if you hunt out of a climber. Of course, Latitude makes some of our favorite saddles and climbing sticks, but they also make some great packs and backpack straps that you can attach to the bottom of a climbing tree stand to make it more comfortable to carry in the woods. Probably my favorite piece of gear I've gotten in the last several years is the Ranger 22 from Latitude. It's like a do-it-all backpack for me. It's compact, which I like, but it's adjustable enough that it gets me through the whole season. It's the only pack I use. I use it in early bow season, when I'm not carrying much in the woods, all the way to late January rut hunts in the deep south when it's cold and I'm carrying all kinds of clothes and all kinds of stuff on my back. The Ranger 22 is adjustable enough that I can just use that one backpack all season. And hey, all you Mossy Oak Bottomland fans, they just released the Ranger 22 in Mossy Oak Bottomland. So like I said, no matter how you like to hunt, Latitude's got something for you. Go check them out at latitudeoutdoors.com.
Well, guys, meet your new favorite summer scouting optic, and no, it's never too early to start scouting for the fall. Introducing the Vortex Crossfire Spotting Scopes with three different models of how you glass. Me and Andrew have both used spotting scopes in the summer to go out and glass fresh, clear cuts that's got a little bit of growth on them to find bachelor groups actually feeding in the summer. It's a pretty fun time, and also it's a great opportunity to take your kids out, especially if you can sit in the truck while you're glassing. It's always one of those pieces of optics like to keep in the truck at all times because you never know when you might need it. Be sure to stop by your local Vortex dealer to get out the all-new Crossfire Spotting Scopes or to get 10% off your favorite spotter, head over to eurooptic.com and enter code Southern10 at checkout to save 10% on your order.
You know, one reason that we named our company the Southern Outdoorsman is because we're not just Southern deer hunters or Southern turkey hunters. We kind of hunt everything: quail, doves, waterfowl, rabbits, squirrels, you name it. I know a lot of you guys are the same way, and our friends at Whitetail Hill are like that as well. Whether you've got a hunting club, a lease, or your own property, they've got a blend for pretty much every situation on a piece of ground. I mean, they've got a seed blend for everything. If you want warm season deer forage, check out Summer Bulk. If you need to screen off a plot or cover an access route, Hideaway grows up to 12 feet tall and is built for that exact purpose. You got a duck hole or a pond edge? Check out the waterfowl blend. You want to plant for doves or quail? Check out their dove and quail plot. If you need soil that needs a little bit of work before fall, check out Dirt Doctor. And of course, they got a full cool season lineup ready to go when fall planting time gets here. And if you're unsure about what to plant, go to whitetailhill.com. They've got a seed selection guide on there that'll help you pinpoint exactly what you need on your property. So y'all check them out today. That's Whitetail Hill. Go to whitetailhill.com. You know, most hunters don't think about their food plots until it's time to throw down some seed for the fall. And if that's the case, you might be leaving a lot on the table. If you want deer using your plots when season opens, you need to give them a reason to be there all summer long. That's how you build movement patterns. Not hoping for them in October, establish them in June. On top of that, bucks are growing antlers right now, does are about to be nursing fawns, and your plots can be a real herd health tool during the summer months, not just a hunting tool come fall. Whitetail Hill has a warm season lineup built exactly for this. Summer Bulk is their big warm season forage blend. It grows 4 to 5 feet tall, holds up to browsing pressure way better than something like soybeans, and it'll carry all the way to the first frost. So it doubles down as a early season food plot for us down here in the South. Then if your soil needs a little bit of work first, check out Dirt Doctor. It builds topsoil, breaks up compaction, and gets your plots in shape for a great fall planting. So check out Summer Bulk and Dirt Doctor at whitetailhill.com. Again, that's whitetailhill.com. Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the Southern Outdoorsman podcast. We had a recent series where we ended up talking about moon a little bit, and it created quite a bit of discussion amongst our listeners on all things moon phase. So we figured that we would just go right to one of the sources and get one of the leading guys on moon phase in the country on here, Mr. Bill Vail. Bill, how are you doing?
Doing great, man.
Awesome. Glad to hear it. I've also got Jacob Myers, the ginger bow hunter, to my right, and Pepper in between us.
Yep, doing well. Super excited to have this conversation. And we're also joined by our good buddy, Michael Pike. The Dilla himself is on this podcast. What's going on, Mike?
Nothing much. Looking forward to this one.
Oh, yeah, dude. This one's been a little bit in the making. I think we had talked about, Mike, I think you and me had talked about doing this episode with Bill last year. And after we did the episode on the wind rule, which maybe we can look up that episode number and put in the show notes from Bill, your first episode you did with us. But, you know, we talked about this episode, about doing this topic last year. It never kind of came to fruition. But after doing this episode series with Shane Parker and Paul Patera on this trail cam study that Shane had done, and Mike, you had noticed, some stuff that you were like, dude, there's some interesting details here of how, you know, potentially some of this deer movement really lined up with certain timings with overhead underfoot positioning of the moon and just other aspects too, specifically a perigee and a few other things, which we're going to talk about today. In that first episode, we actually had you on, Bill, which is called The Wind Rule, which is a very interesting podcast. That was episode 282. Definitely, you know, if you're a new listener, go back and listen to that episode 282. But Bill, we're super excited diving into this, especially because you've been studying the moon for, I think, almost over 40 years and, built out a calendar around it, which is really interesting. And we're going to dive into all things lunar today. So, Bill, how should we start this conversation and kind of get into this topic? Because it is a very in-depth discussion here.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank you guys at the Southern Outdoorsman, and I want to thank the Lord for making this possible. As a matter of fact, when I wanted to start it out with a couple Bible verses. I don't need to necessarily read them, but the verse that tipped me off about the moon and the moonlight was in Genesis 14 through 19. I learned in Bible college that whenever the Lord repeats himself, that you really need to pay attention to that. And between 14 and 19, he repeats the word light 8 times. And then 2 Peter 2:12, which simply states, don't be like unreasoning animals who operate on instinct alone, meaning that animals can't reason or think. They operate entirely on instinct. And I believe those things wholeheartedly. And that's what got me going on it years ago, was God's word. So I want to ask you guys, what is the biggest problem we as public land hunters face?
Probably hunting pressure.
Pressure, and that results in nocturnal movement. You know, everybody gets a lot of pictures at night, and I do too. But after studying this stuff for years and trail camera information, I came up with some very, very interesting things. And the first thing I want to say is that animals, deer in particular, are crepuscular, meaning they're active during twilight, before and after. And so twilight becomes a very, very important aspect of ambushing what I call light wary bucks. Deer that when it gets light, they're headed home, okay? There's three stages to twilight, and it's civil twilight. In the evening, it comes first. And that's when it becomes difficult to read a newspaper with 20/20 vision. Then there's nautical twilight. That's when sailors can get out and start using their sextants and things like that. And then there's astronomical twilight. That's for the telescope guys. And then darkness. And in the morning, it's reversed, astronomical, nautical, and civil twilight. Well, where am I going with all this? Big bucks under pressure are light-sensitive animals. And if we can learn how to trick them with the light, and that's about what I'm going to teach you in this part of the moon, yeah, I'm hunting by moonlight, and everybody's going to go, oh, my word, he's hunting after dark. No, I'm hunting some situations where we have visible moonlight in the sky during twilight or before. Okay. And how does this help us? Deep woods twilight is different than open field twilight. When you're in the canopy, say in the morning, it starts to get daylight, you can't notice the horizon coming near as fast as if you're out where there's no canopy, an open field or things like that. Okay, so in the morning, if you have a moon out reflecting light as the sun is rising, it disguises the arrival of daylight. In other words, they cannot sense it coming near as quickly as on a day when there's no moon around at all and it starts getting light. Does that make sense? Okay. So you add clouds to that scenario, and it makes it even better. So on mornings when I'd like to ambush big bucks, you know, if I can, you know, if it's set by the calendar, and I can, and with my calendar, you can chart all this stuff ahead of time. So I would want to set in what I call a light break. That's where open field twilight exists within the deep woods canopy scenario. So power lines, two tracks, rivers, even some creeks, clear cuts, any place where the railroad tracks, any place where the sun can shine in and open field twilight exists. So what we try to do is when the big buck starts to sense this getting daylight, he may very well duck out of the field before it is for completion of twilight. Now he ducks into the dark timber and he walks along and he's aware of the overall light, but he's not aware that there's a place where he can be sniped off legally during, say, civil twilight as he steps out of the duck canopy onto an open power line. Okay, so you can see better there. Small openings in the woods, anytime that I can set up where I can see better, I will sacrifice closer position, because the closer position is not going to do me no good if I can't see the shooting. But do you understand that? And in the evening, you don't want any reflective light in the sky. Once again, clouds help, because it turns his evening bedding area in the canopy darker sooner. And then with the clouds, it even enhances it even further. So breaking it down, it's like when the tip of the sun hits the trees going down at night, the light starts diminishing. When the sun disappears, we have sunset. And shortly, 15 minutes after that, we have civil twilight. 15 minutes after that, we have nautical twilight. And then after nautical twilight, legal shooting time is up here in Michigan, and I start packing it up, you know, to get out of there. So learning how to use the light against these animals is a deadly concept because, and by the way, I've never heard of anybody else talk about this information. This is kind of something that I've been teaching on Zoom, and it kind of goes by a lot of people. In my book, this is explained in a lot more detail. But so you have you have a light exchange at twilight is what I'm talking about. There's a light exchange. When the moon's out reflecting light in the morning, it's good. You add clouds to that, it's even better. No moon reflecting at night. And if you have clouds, it's even better because it just tricks the animal. He's used to leaving his bedding area at a light level that's comfortable to him. He's not looking at a wristwatch like we are. Does that make sense?
No, that makes perfect sense. So you can kind of leverage that that cloudy day with no reflective moon or anything like that, where it's going to get darker earlier to make him get up and move. And, you know, you're going to be set up there close to bedding, so that works in your favor.
Yeah, Bill, I was going to say, one of our past guests,
Mr. Troy Pottinger out of Idaho, who's a big buck killer from up there. He talks about this specifically and where he likes to target these big bucks, which is in big closed canopy forests where the light level's much dimmer throughout the day, and those bucks definitely like to move much more during daylight hours at better times for a hunter, again, during legal times, compared to being in an area with a lot more open landscape. And he's had a ton of success.
He's right about that, and the thing about it is I've even seen him in the morning use the east side of fields, and in the evening use the west side of fields to accommodate what I call shadow movement. They can't be seen near as well, and they're a creature that doesn't like exposure, you know. So, yes, I'm glad to hear that there's another hunter out there that's tuning in. And yeah, during the day with cloudy weather, the canopy's a good bet, because you're right, the light is dimmed down, you know, and they feel safer. Something about the light level, it can actually make them feel safer. Now, if you have a big swamp that's open with no trees, and you're trying to draw him into the timber at night to feed on acorns, that's like a dead-end hunt, because it's not going to be dark in the swamp, and by the time he gets up to move at a low light level, it is dark in the woods, and you can't shoot him. So, you know, understanding it's easier to pull him out of the canopy into the light, and you can turn that around in the morning. You can hunt the edge of the swamp, and now he's in the canopy. He's liable to show up late because of the light level. And this is all charted on my calendar. And you read about it in, you know, in my book. There's also sometimes a gravitational exchange that takes place. I honestly believe that the big bucks can sense daylight coming about 45 minutes before the sun rises, because their biorhythms pick up the gravitational pull of the arrival of the sun.
So, Bill, one thing I wanted to ask about with all that stuff you just said was like the light exchanges or light breaks, where you're talking about intentionally hunting either a morning or an afternoon hunt in a spot that has some kind of light advantage, kind of like we were just talking about. Correct me if I'm wrong, but is that something that you're just trying to apply to spots that you've already found that are good spots based on the sign or whatever? Or are you seeking spots out based on the fact that you can have that light advantage?
Well, I mean, to tell you the truth, I go into a new area and there's canopy on both sides and I've got a power line. I'll put my stand on the line every time. Not only can I have the light advantage, but I've got long range visibility up and down the line. And I can give you an example of how I shot one like that. I placed my stand on the line. Of course, I had researched this deer. I knew he was there. And about 2 hours before dark, two guys come down the line. They ducked into the woods, kind of cutting me off from where I thought the buck was going to come from. And they waved at me, and I waved at them. And then the evening progressed, and right before it was still plenty of light for me out on the line, I seen their flashlights in the woods. And they come out, stepped onto the line, turned their flashlights off because they didn't need them anymore. They waved at me, and I waved at them again. And about 10 minutes later, the buck tracked them out of there. And I had still plenty of light on the line to get a legal shot because I was in a light break. Obviously, it was too dark in the woods to shoot, or they wouldn't have left.
That makes perfect sense. So is that a spot that you went into and you kind of had the idea that, hey, this is a light break, and you were setting up for a situation like that? Because it sounds like when you're setting up for that kind of situation, you're setting up to shoot one either right at the first crack of dawn or right at the last bit of light in the evening.
Well, during twilight and no later than the end of nautical twilight in the evening, and no earlier than nautical twilight in the morning. We got to be done hunting 30 minutes after sunset, but actually the light starts dimming down as soon as the sun hits the horizon.
So was there a particular moon overhead or cloud cover, you know, that you're using in addition to, you know, I guess the the amount of canopy cover.
Yeah, if I have clouds, that's great, but I'll try it without clouds. It still works. It's just not as effective as, you know, without clouds. But clouds, you know, clouds going along with reflective light, clouds are good both morning and evening, middle of the day, you know, if you're hunting ridges and feeding areas in the middle of the day and things like that. Yeah.
Well, Bill, I want to kind of get you back in the conversation we were having a little early before having some technical issues. You're talking about that that east and west kind of thermal that happens and kind of how some of those bucks will play off that, and then we can kind of get more and more into some of this discussion of how, you know, some of these different factors, you know, maybe a fact or not necessarily caused, but enhanced when we're starting to look at, you know, moon overhead, moon underfoot, perigee, and a lot more terminology here for a lot of our listeners.
Oh, sure. We'll cover that in detail. The east wind thermal at dawn happens when the weatherman says it's going to be calm or light and variable. Okay. For years, I would go in, you know, and then they're telling you after daylight, a southwest wind's going to arrive. So if I go to my southwest stand and it's calm and we get that east wind thermal at dawn, it's going to push my wind across the run that I was hoping to be downwind of. And I've gotten caught by multiple big bucks doing that until I figured out what was going on. The only two answers I have to it is set two stands or just set on the ground, you know, 30 yards west of the tree that you're going to be hunting in until the winds for the day arrive, and then just get up and go climb your tree and get in.
With the east wind thermal, so I'm assuming that has something to do with the sun rising in the east, and that's kind of pulling the air over in that direction?
Well, it's heating the air, and it repels away from the sun. You can see it with your breath, but you can't feel it. You know, you can see that your wind's going east. I'm sitting here saying to myself, why on earth am I having an east wind when it's supposed to be southwest, you know? So,
yeah,
and that's just something, you know, it's just a little trick. If you're aware of it, you can do something about it. But if you're not aware of it, you'll always wonder, why did I get busted? Why was the wind east under calm and light and variable conditions? Right when the sun becomes visible, it will start that repelling process. So right after daylight, you know, and that's a lot of times when they come through. So the highly pressured deer.
Does that hold true in flatland, but also hill country or mountainous terrain?
I'm sure it holds. I haven't hunted a lot of mountainous terrain. I've hunted some pretty big 1,500 foot ridges. And I can't really say that I've experienced that, but, you know, in the ridges, but I can say that I've never had trouble with thermals anyway. I hunt high stands and blow off steep areas, and that can, you know, when you're hunting for a big buck and you don't want him to catch you, one mistake like that, he nails you there. You know, he might be done for the year on that run, or be at least be done coming through it. I don't want to discuss thermals in the hill country because it there's a lot of information out there, and like I said, I've never had trouble with them. Rising thermals have helped me. Of course, I always hunt on top, and dropping thermals. You know, you figure the max speed of a thermal is 8 miles an hour. And usually it's only 2 or 3 miles an hour. So a 10-mile-an-hour wind will overpower the thermal to carry it off a steep drop-off. It'll still fall as it gets out there, but within bow range of your stand, you're still good.
Now, Bill, kind of getting back on, you know, some of those topics that I know we're going to be discussing tonight. You know, I think there's a lot of listeners out there, especially after this the series we had done with Shane Parker and Paul Patera, where we started getting into some of the data that they had found based off different moon positioning along with different phases of the moon itself, potentially, you know, having some insight on, you know, expanding, you know, deer movement or also enhancing deer movement, you know, with other conditions. Let's kind of look at getting some of that discussion, because I know you have a lot kind of written down, some different talking points and discussions here, because again, you've studied this for, I think, over close to 40 years. And been very well invested in looking at some of these outlying factors that can, you know, potentially enhance deer movement. And I know you and me had a conversation about this a few weeks ago when we were talking about scheduling this episode, especially in regards to enhancing movement around potentially storm fronts and what that may look like in just overall, overall landscape when it comes to the whitetail hunting. So, the table's kind of yours, or the mic's kind of yours, to kind of walk through this, because, again, I'm still so green at this. My overall outlook for anything that comes to Lunar is Michael Pike, who always brings up in different conversations, and, again, a lot of times it goes over mine and Andrew's head. But definitely, you know, me and Andrew are very green at this and want to kind of come from that perspective with this conversation and looking at, you know, what do we need to learn and do to help us become more efficient, especially when we start looking at, like, say, your calendar and potentially figuring out, you know, if someone is, say, a weekend hunter or has very limited time off, how to kind of plan their, you know, time off or plan their hunts based off some other outlying factors that make them more successful.
Well, you know, I hunt storm fronts too, and they are wonderful because you get a lot of movement forces going, you know, a change in wind direction, a change in wind speed, precipitation, drop in barometric pressure. And whenever I can stack four or more like that on top of one another, yeah, I like that. But the problem with storm fronts is that generally you only get 2 or 3 days notice that they're coming. And a lot of times they change at the last minute. Whereas with the moon times on my calendar, I can chart days ahead, months, and even a year ahead of time that I know are going to be good. And then if I get weather enhancing conditions, all the better. So to limit my time on stand, I target what I call the sweet spots.
Well, let's talk about that, because I'm very interested in learning a little bit more about these sweet spots. And, you know, I know we got listeners now wondering, like, okay, what do you mean by, you know, charting this out and figuring out, like, what this means when it comes to movement? So maybe we should step back a second and just learn a little bit more about, you know, some other terminology here and some of your take on how moon can and does potentially affect deer movement, and specifically mature buck movement, to give you a better odds of hunting versus just, some of these other outlying factors that people are much more aware of when it comes to, you know, temperature drops, you know, storm fronts, stuff like that. Maybe we can talk about, like, what can enhance deer movement based off what you've learned, you know, when it comes to studying the moon.
Well, let's just take the first 4 days of October. We've got yellow star evenings, okay, which means that the deer are very active. And as a matter of fact, the first quarter always follows the new moon. And a lot of times the effects of the rut haven't quite worn off yet. And so those evenings, they're marked with perigee as well. Those are you're gonna hear about some big bucks falling the first 4 days of the season, and they will be shot in the evening. On those days, morning hunting won't be that good because the big bucks will be back to their beds, depending on how much pressure they're on, up to 2 hours before daylight. So now when it comes time to move, they've been there 2 hours longer. They're ready to move. And now the moon is telling them to move. And so you have a very good chance of connecting on those 4 evenings, especially since we have the added effects of perigee. And I might as well go in and cover that a little bit. They will show you on a calendar and any of the other calendars, perigee is 1 day. Okay, that's what they say. But our tides are affected a lot up to 3 days before the day of perigee. And the day of perigee, they'll be affected the most. And then there's the waning off period. So for deer hunting, the effects of perigee play into an entire week, 7 days. And the pulls of the moon are going to be stronger than they were for the entire rest of the month. So they sense this gravitational pull through their biorhythms. My calendar also has a lag time. In other words, my moon times, they track the overhead and the underneath moon. But like I said, the 7 days of perigee, there's 3 days leading into it, the day of, and 3 days leading out. Then perigee begins to wane away towards apogee. But it's still another few days after that before, you know, 14 days later, you're going to have apogee. And that's when the moon's at its furthest point from the Earth. I don't mark apogee on my calendar because that's kind of, to me, like normal. But I do track perigee because that is abnormal, and it really brings out the movement. And it's something that, you know, that people could think about is when the moon swings into position, micro life is affected first. So let's pretend like we're fishing. Moon swings into position. The plankton starts getting active, which stimulates the minnows. They're a little heavier in weight. So now the minnows feed on the plankton, which stirs up the panfish through the stimuli of the minnows moving. And then finally the predator fish come in. Same above the ground. Insects, then the birds, then the bigger birds. And then it's on up the food chain. That's why my calendar has a lag time built in. John Alden Knight said it was because deer were a higher order of species, but I pinned it down to the weight. Simply a 250-pound deer is not going to feel the moon near as early as a fawn or a doe.
And just real quick, because just for some terminology, I know Michael Pike in our very first episode in our last series with Shane Parker and Paul Patera had brought up perigee, I think within the first 15 minutes. I had never heard that term before, and I was over there super confused by it. Can you talk about, just describe, what is perigee and what is apogee? You kind of mentioned what apogee was, which is the farthest point the moon is.
Perigee is when the moon reaches its closest point for the month on a given day. And then it starts getting, as it goes around the Earth, it gets further and further away. So it's at its closest point. Now, perigee, in this case, with the first quarter in October, is a real sweet spot. October 3rd is going to be a dynamite evening. It's the night of the first quarter. And you're going to have moon right overhead, north-south line, right before dark. And so it's swinging into position. But like I said, the heavier an animal is, the longer it takes for him to respond to it, up to a point. So perigee is just simply the moon's at its closest point. The reason why I know that it affects for 3 days before is if you look at study the tide tables. When it's apogee, the difference between low tide and high tide is not very much, but during perigee, the difference between low tide and high tide may be quite a bit. And, you know, fishermen along the coast, they know all about this stuff, you know, because they're fishing either high or low water, whatever the case may be. But perigee is a 7 day period as far as hunting goes, and I've even seen the effects of perigee last a couple of days longer than that.
Now, Pike, I've got to ask you, Pike, what questions do you have? Because, I mean, you brought this up with us in that series. And, again, me and Andrew were like, what the heck are you talking about, Dave? But after kind of, you know, hearing some of this, what's some questions or thoughts you have when we're, you know, discussing perigee and apogee?
Well, as you're talking about this, are we in perigee right now? Or
perigee starts Saturday.
Okay. I was just curious.
It lasts through the 6th of the month.
Okay. I was just curious because...
Actually, it may start Friday.
Okay.
Maybe perigee today, as far as my calendar is concerned. But the day of perigee would be... could be the night of the first quarter or the night after. I'm not sure. 1, 2, 3, 4, 7. No, it is... perigee will land on the 4th.
Okay.
The day of perigee. But I'm telling you, the effects of perigee are still there for 3 days before that day and for 3 days after. And on my calendar, I have a P on every one of those days.
Yeah. I was just going to bring up as a side note, I've noticed some really big swings in, because I work in the ER, and the amount of people we see and the amount of problems that are going on, like I see these huge, huge swings in the amount of people and influx of people that we have coming to the ER. And I didn't know if that may be what I'm seeing even there or not. We can cut this part out. I was just curious when that paired you was, because the past couple of days, like, we've had this huge influx of people, like, out of nowhere, like, where it was, like, pretty calm and dead, and then just out of nowhere, it's just, like, people coming out of the woodworks.
Well, I have that written down, that emergency rooms, police calls, deer dying during the day and at night on the highways, it jumps real good. Leads me to the story about the guy that he was always pretty successful. I met him about 20 years ago, and he told me, he goes, I always kill mine during the rut. And I just asked him, I said, well, how do you know every year when the rut is? He goes, well, I drive to work every day, and when I start seeing dead deer all over the highway, I take time off. And it's a crude way of pinpointing the rut, but it worked for him.
Yeah, interesting.
There's definitely a lot more deer car accidents during the full moon, the new moon, and during perigee. And sometimes perigee falls right on the same day as the new moon. And when you get that, you get a week of hunting that Native Americans used to call the moon of madness.
That's really interesting.
Mm-hmm. And that's why I wanted to actually get into, which was talking about new moon versus full moon versus the other kind of sectors of the moon phase itself. We had, you know, based off that study, what Shane had done, showed, of course, the full moon and new moon both having the highest amount of daylight movement based off his study compared to the other, positioning of the moon or other phases of the moon, shall I say. What is kind of your take on, especially when we're talking like daylight movement and some effects there? You know, we talked a little bit about the perigee, and the perigee is extremely important from what you're saying. But how does that kind of overlay potentially throughout each month, where that may fall on, you know, a different kind of phase of the moon? Or is it pretty similar every single month where it's going to fall like on the first quarter or, like you said, the new moon every now and then?
It will be similar every month that year. But perigee can fall during any one of the phases at any time. And so last year we had perigee during the new moon week. It wasn't right on the same day, but if it was, then you'd have a super moon. And about, I think it was 2000, either 19 or 20, I don't remember. I went to North Ohio in January during the that's when Boston got washed away. And you look that up, that was caused by a super moon, which is perigee, and the full moon or new moon aligning together with a fierce winter storm. So it went over their levees. You know, that was the closest position, the most pull, the most impact the moon was going to have on the planet and probably another 147 years now, something like that. And that's why Boston got washed away. You look it up on the internet, they'll tell you exactly what I just said. It was either the new moon, I think it was the new moon. I went in before daylight. I had a doe and a fawn pass my stand at daylight. I didn't see anything else until about 1 o'clock. Between 1 and 3 o'clock, I saw over 75 deer. A lot of them right out in the open feeding, and there was some chasing going on back and forth with the bucks. And then they all went back into their cover, and right before dark, the same doe and fawn passed me. My point here is guys that are hunting morning and evening and not thinking about the middle of the day are making a mistake. Michael Yates, you know, and I agree 100% on this, that deer, especially big bucks, are conditioned to know hunters be in the woods at midday. You know, so the pressure drops way off, and it's just a conditioned response. They haven't had trouble in the middle of the day, so they're more apt to move at midday.
So, Bill, one of the questions I had just while we're talking about, again, moon phase, and we're going to get in a lot more in depth here on this podcast, is you hear from a lot, or we hear from a lot of guys, I'm sure you do too, that they speak about specific moon phases. You know, talk about new moon, full moon, waning gibbous, the last quarter, first quarter, the waning crescent, waxing crescent, the whole nine yards. That certain ones they believe they see more deer during daylight hours compared to others are like it's a terrible moon phase if, you know, this is something that they track. And then you have a lot of guys that just don't care about it in general. What is your take on the different moon phases specifically and any that may enhance daylight movement versus maybe not so much? And do you have any kind of observation that you can give us on that?
Well, like I said, with the full moon, the main activity period is going to be right in the middle of the day. And either day, either side of that, it's going to be, you know, sort of in the middle of the day. But like in ridge country, where he's coming in and bedding down at daylight, and I recommend setting up right in his feeding area in the acorns in the ridges. But you have to get there before daylight and hopefully beat him when he comes in, and then take advantage of him moving toward the feeding area at midday, because he's not going to move far during the full moon. He's not going to leave his safety cover, but he will get up and feed on the acorns right there. So it creates a problem. If you try to go in at midday or, you know, 10 o'clock or something to catch him at midday, he's liable to spot you because he's not going to move very far from his bed. So you have to be there ahead of time. And that's basically why I don't do a lot of full moon hunting. It just seems stagnant to me. I have killed a couple of deer during the full moon, but it's been under the situation that I just told you about, getting there ahead of time and rising and feeding going on at midday, and they don't go very far, but they come far enough. Then we have the last quarter, or the after the full moon, we have the last quarter, and the moon would be in perfect position right at dawn, directly overhead the north-south line. And for the next four mornings or so, he can show up headed for his bed twilight, then it's a little after twilight, then it can be a little later. And on those days, I recommend just getting in there an hour before daylight and hunting through midday and then leaving. Okay. Like I said, the full moon is a feeding, more of a feeding moon. And I consider the third quarter the same thing. The new moon, however, is a breeding moon. And this adds lots of activity to it. So on those days, I'll hunt directly in the bedding cover or on its approach trail to the cover. And once again, wait for activity to stir up midday. But now we have a breeding moon, and that means that the deer are going to be chasing. So setting up in small blocks of cover with limited room, they get to chasing around. It's a matter of time till he gives up the shot. Okay. So, and then the evening moon is just what we've been talking about. Get to your stand at your normal evening hunting time and hunt it through dark. And that could be in the first quarter. Like I said, the new moon always precedes the first quarter. And if you have perigee, like we have in October, activity with the breeding could still be winding down. And that's why the first quarter, well, those 4 days of that first quarter that are marked with yellow stars will always be the best evenings in any given month. So as far as phase hunting goes, that's how it works. But understanding that you may want to set your stand between bed and feed, I always try to set up as close to his occupied bed as I can without disturbing him or the deer. And by the way, I always try for a buck first in the evening. I set three stands. I set one for the evening, one for the morning, and one right over his bed. Obviously, if you go in and hunt the one right over his bed first, If you blow it there, he catches you. Now you don't even have a chance in the morning and the evening because he's not going to come back for a while. So no evening ambush and no morning ambush. So I would hunt evening for him. If the evening scenario didn't work, I'd try to take him off his morning trail. And if that didn't work, then I move right into the bedding cover and try to catch him either during the full moon or the new moon, moving around at midday.
Interesting. So I just want to make this one statement or statement/question just to make sure also tracking during that full moon and the new moon, that's the kind of time period when you're going to catch him moving around in his core little bedding area per se throughout the day, more so than on bigger paths of travel outside of that bedding area.
Yeah, like I said, even with the first quarter at night, I still try to hunt as close to his occupied bed as I can and get away with it. And I do the same in the morning. I'm not much for setting feeding areas, and neither is Michael Yates. That's where a lot of the other hunters are going to be, and that's where a lot of the pressure is going to be. And also, that's where they're going to be the most cautious as they're approaching their feed.
Well, let me ask you this, Bill, to kind of work our way through some more of these topics. What would be the next point that we really need to look at and kind of learn from, especially when you're talking to, you know, me and Andrew, which are still very green at a lot of this? Again, Michael Pike has, you know, a lot more experience, but still there's a lot to be learned in these discussions. So what would be that next point that we really ought to discuss and look at to kind of start looking more so into these topics?
Well, let's talk about the chain reaction in movement. And what that means, usually the does and the fawns rise first. They weigh the least amount, so they feel the effects of the gravitational pull first. Then the skipper bucks see them go to the field. This stimulates them. They're a little heavier, and now they feel the effects of the moon, and that pulls them toward the field or toward their food source. Then finally, the older, heavier bucks, they begin to feel the effects of the moon. So like if I'm on stand and early, 150-pound buck shows up and he's there early, and you know, he may be a shooter or he may not, you know, maybe just under what I want to shoot. Fact is, I know there's a heavier one back there if I've been after a heavier one. So like I said, it's how much they weigh. And that's why I have a lag time on my calendar that's basically set for 200-pound deer. My lag time, I think, is an hour and a half past what they say as far as what's an overhead moon. It would be an hour and a half past that before the big one would be on his feet. Now, he can get up early, and I've had that happen, but I like to get to my stand just before the deer are going to move for scent reasons. The longer you're there, the more scent you put out, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, immaculate timing is critical. However, if the does are on their feet and you can be picked up by the does, you may want to just go ahead and go with the reg, you know, take an hour and a half off the time and go in at that time. But I don't do that. In Michigan here, the pressure is to the point to where it's usually within the last hour of daylight or dark when I have my action as far as movement to and from the bed.
And that's a good point you were talking about, or an interesting point, should I say, about like the body size of the animal. And what you're seeing is, again, like those smaller body deer are going to be the first ones to move that feel that effect. And, you know, those bigger bucks are going to be the last ones to feel the effect and the last ones to kind of get up and move. And that's the reason why you've kind of shifted that timing about an hour, hour and a half after what a lot of the other charts mention, which I will say is interesting because where we're at in the country, specifically, like, say, in Alabama, like, a mature buck could be anywhere between 150 pounds or he could be all the way up to over 200 pounds, depending on where you're at in the state. Like, I killed one last year that was 5.5 years old that was 100 and probably – maybe 150 pounds. He might have been 140 pounds. Again, he was a very small body deer and, you know, killed him during the rut. And that kind of brings up a question. If you're in one of these states or one of these areas where a mature buck might only be 150 to 175 pounds, what would that look like when it comes to that overall movement? Would it be a little more, again, earlier compared to potentially what your calendar is currently showing?
I would take 30 minutes off what my calendar says for Michigan deer then, and try that if you're not having activity. So you also got to remember pressure and the light level, like we talked about, and all that plays into the picture. So, yeah, they can move what I'm going to call calculated moon time, which is done mathematically. But here where I hunt, we have, you know, in the northern states, we have to add an hour to an hour and a half to the moon time. John Alden Knight said it was because deer, because he was a famous fisherman, he fished by the moon. He's Hall of Famers, him and his son both. You know, he said it was because they were a higher order of species, but I don't think that's right. And for all the good information I learned from him, I hate to say that I think he's wrong, but I've learned that it's the weight. It's the weight of the animal that you're hunting. And it would be ridiculous to say, well, I'm hunting for a 175 pound deer, so I'm going to take 15 minutes off for this much weight and for that much weight. Honestly, if you wanted to get there early, you like to hunt, no problem in that. Like I said, here where I hunt, the deer are under so much pressure that usually by 2 hours after twilight, it's over in the morning, and 2 hours before twilight in the evening. So when I go hunting in the evening around here, if it gets dark at 7, I'm stand about 4:30.
Bill, I don't think this is going to derail the conversation, or I hope it doesn't, but I'm just curious because I'm curious to learn what this terminology means. I hear a lot of guys talk about the red moon or some like red moon phase or something like that. Or what is that?
I'm not familiar with that terminology. I go by first, last, quarter, full, and new moon. I'm not familiar with the red moon terminology.
Mike, am I saying that? Am I missaying that term, or is there another way to say it? Because I've had other guys talk about. I thought they said red moon.
Well, I'd have to know what phase they're talking about for a red moon. If I had to guess, I would say it'd be one of the quarter moons, but I'm not, because a full moon is a full moon, and the new moon's a new moon. They're using that terminology as a quarter moon.
The red moon, as I understand it, was just when their normal feeding times would be like their crepuscular movement, whether it be, you know, in the morning or in the evening. So whenever we have that overhead, it would be around that time, which you've kind of already hit on in a different way.
Okay, so basically what they're saying is a red moon is the moon at transit, or a moon underfoot probably then.
As it lines up with their typical movement, you know, that crepuscular movement, like you're talking about, the civil twilight, that overhead and underfoot lining up around that time, I think is what they were kind of getting at.
Okay. Like I said, maybe I'll have to look that up and see exactly what they're talking about before I can answer that intelligently. I don't want to make a guess at something that I haven't researched.
Yeah, no worries. Well, let's look at a couple other points here, because I know you have some other interesting discussions for us tonight and for this episode. So what would be like kind of our next step after we're kind of learning through some of these different terms, the different effects and everything that you've kind of studied? What's kind of that next point that we really need to kind of dive into or get you to kind of educate us on? Because, again, I look at this conversation very much differently from a lot of our other guests. It's almost kind of similar to Bobby Worthington. Like, there's a lot to learn from you that just personally I don't have a ton of experience on. So, you know, very much here to learn as much as I can from this conversation here, Bill.
Well, so, like, in the evening, ideally, I would, like, during a first quarter moon, I would want to try to find a light break. And you can't always find them. Sometimes you just have to hunt where you have to hunt. But if you know what you're looking for, and you understand how to use it and how it's going to work for you, Then when you're walking down through the woods, you can say, hey, this is a small opening, maybe 40 yards across with no trees. I can see right here. I've got a few scrapes right here. Perfect place to set up for an evening ambush. Because you're going to be able to see later. And if he's bedded in the canopy, you know, he just may very well show up early because of the light level tricks him, going back to the light level. So you use the, you're using the light level against him. You're setting up in a light break. You're trying to do everything you can to maximize your light. The gravitational pulls going on too, that's just wonderful. You know, so a lot of times these variables will stack right up in a given couple of days, and it's, you know, a gold mine. Then other times you may be battling, you know, yeah, you've got the light break, yeah, you've got movement time, but you got a bright moon out there reflecting light, say after the first quarter, no clouds, and he just doesn't show up near as early. And as a matter of fact, he may not show up until after dark on those days. So it's a waste of time to hunt when I think the chances are for him to show up after shooting light. I want to maximize everything I can to make sure that if he does show up, I'm in a good spot to be able to see to shoot him.
Now, Bill, is this something that also can be seen through, you know, listeners' trail cameras, of kind of maybe like they get a buck on camera right at that last light? You know, trail cameras are pretty notorious, especially if you have them in the timber. They'll kind of fool you if you look at them real quickly and not paying attention at the time, where it may look dark on the camera, but it's still legal shooting light. But, you know, and the buck may be showing up. But if you were in that spot at that time, you may not actually have enough light in that canopy, like what you're saying, where that buck's moving around from his bed. But again, it's just dark enough inside that timber. You're really going to struggle to get a shot off, especially if we're talking bow hunting here, you know, during that time period of, you know, he's up and moving, but inside that canopy is still just a touch too dark for you to really be able to get a good look at him, or even be able to see your pins for that matter of sake.
Right. Yeah. That's what we battle with pressured deer and nocturnal movement. I have hunted for some old bucks that never followed any of this stuff. In other words, they just would not leave their bed until it was like an hour after dark. Never did get a picture of him in daylight, and they just lived out their lives in the dark as far as I knew. That's what happens when they get older. Actually, the hardest bucks to shoot are between in their prime, because they can stay down during cold weather a lot better. When a big buck gets older, arthritis and things like that. As a matter of fact, most of the big bucks I've shot have been over 8 years old. I haven't shot a lot of deer that are, you know, 4.5 to say 7.5. They learn young. They get conditioned that daylight means death. And they just don't move. And I mean, there's a lot of them like that. I have tried pushing those deer. Me and my buddies get together, and he won't move during daylight, so we'll try a push on him.
Interesting. Well, I've got to ask, you know, as we're kind of talking through some of these points, again, then I feel like there's a lot here that we're kind of leaving on the table, as in, you know, some other things that you've kind of learned, that's some interesting points to discuss. So, what else, you know, during this conversation that's of value? Because I know there's a lot here to kind of be discussed. So, Bill, again, kind of putting it in your hands here, what would be that next point for us to kind of discuss and learn a little bit more about this overall topic?
Now, like I said, it's harder to pull a deer out of an open swamp into the canopy than it is to pull one out of the canopy into the open, especially if it is an opening with a light break. That trick right there has probably got me a lot of shots that I wouldn't have gotten, you know, just simply because I tried hunting closer to his bed in the canopy, and he'd walk by my stand. You know, I'd hear deer coming when it's too dark to shoot. But yet, if I'd have been back in the light break, there still would have been plenty of light to kill him. And I'm not saying don't hunt the canopy, because in places where there's just canopy everywhere, you don't have a lot of choice. And but still, you can find openings. And that's what I look for. It's openings where I'm going to be able to see later because it's such a critical factor. I don't like even taking low light shots. You know, I'm getting older and my eyes are failing me. And it's just like, no, I need even broad daylight or good light, you know, where I've got real good visibility.
And what were the specific days that you said to be hunting those light breaks?
Well, in the evening, a light break works coming from the canopy through the light break back into the canopy. That would be during the first quarter phase. And I would concentrate then at those times in those places. During the third quarter phase, you hunt the light break in the morning as he's coming back through the canopy. Okay.
What specific overhead underfoot times would those be? Do you know those?
Well, yeah, the overhead moon is always going to be that's for hunting the first quarter. The moon will be overhead a few minutes before twilight, dead over the north-south line, and it'll be half full. Even though it's called the quarter moon, it's half full. And those nights it does reflect light. The nights where you have clouds, and the denser the cloud cover, the better your chances of catching him moving. Because like I said, he's leaving his bed at a light level that's comfortable to him. And now it's darker earlier with the moon out reflecting light. Twilight seems to hang on a little longer, and it just creates a window of time where he's vulnerable and he has no idea that he is.
Bill, I have a question about, for guys like Jacob and I, who are kind of new into discussing all these different topics and moon phase and light breaks and all that stuff, but more specifically when it comes to anything that has to do with the moon, what are some ways that guys can kind of start stepping into that and start learning about it on their own? Like, what are the things that they really need to start paying attention to right now, so over the course of this deer season, by the end of it, they have a much better idea of kind of what they saw in their woods, you know, based on their observations?
I tell the beginning people with the calendar to just trust it and follow it. Don't try to understand it because it'll bother your mind. You know, you're trying to figure all these variables. And now I'm used to it. Like I said, I've been doing it for a long time. So it's kind of automatic for me. I know what I'm looking for. I know what I need to have. I know what kind of wind I want. You know, weather conditions can enhance it. You know, clouds, maybe a drop in barometer. So you start stacking on the evening movement. You got clouds. You've got the first quarter. You've got perigee. Now you've got a drop in barometer, maybe some precipitation. Now you're a change in wind direction, a change in wind speed, and that's seven variables that can very well put him on his feet. Combining the moon with weather. You know, the weather can dampen moon movement, like if it's 100 degrees out. I would be tempted to hunt shade routes to water holes. You kind of want to tailor your hunting to what the deer are going to be interested at that time. That's how you get immaculate timing.
So it's almost like with terrain features, we talk about compounding terrain features being a good spot to hunt, but you're also looking at it from the moon perspective where, you know, if you can stack up two or three different factors in that area along with weather, along with barometric pressure, then that's, you know, that's the good day to go hunt. You know, if you only have limited days and you're trying to pick which day to go, stack your odds on those days and pick that day to go, and then go set on some compounding features out in the woods to increase your chances even more.
So you take camera information, and when I get a picture of a big deer, the first thing I do is see what the wind was doing at that time. And then I see what other weather variables were going on. Several pictures of him, it may prove to be that deer is only there during a southwest wind. He's only there during the first quarter moon phase. And so therefore, for me to hunt for him with a different wind and expect him to show up, or a different moon phase, it's not a good idea. Now, will your moon phases always line up with the movement? No. You know, it's kind of like you have to take each day and plot it. And the more information that you record and you get repeated pictures of a big buck, you know, say three or four pictures of him, now you can sit down and say, hey, look, you know, he is not here during a north wind. He is not here during the third quarter. He only shows up during the first quarter, or he only shows up during the new moon. And that happens an awful lot. Before the dark period started here this month, I had no pictures on my cameras yet this year of big bucks or little bucks for that matter. In the last week, I've gotten 12 pictures of bucks and one big shooter. And the shooter was moving at 12:46 the day after the new moon, right in the middle of the day in one of the highest hunting pressured state land areas in the state. So now, next month, I will know that during the new moon, I'll probably go in there at 10 o'clock, hunt till 3 o'clock, and leave. Because he's cued me that that's when he may show up. Or I could go in at 10 o'clock and hunt till dark. Or I could go in the morning and hunt all day. Because during the new moon, the red days on my calendar, it says all day. You don't have to hunt all day. It just simply means there's no wrong time to be in the woods. What you have on the day of the new moon, you have a minor at dawn, the major straight up midday, and a minor at dusk, coinciding with the solar movement. All three of them movements are going to take place in one day. So therefore, they could be moving at any time. And I've shot quite a few big bucks during the new moon, right around midday. And they usually show up all by themselves.
So quick question, Bill. We were doing this trail cam study with Shane on the last podcast, and he noticed that there was a huge spike in movement midday, like you're talking about with the new moon. On the flip side, on the full moon, we noticed that movement was around midnight. And then you would get that dawn and dusk period of movement. Do you also get that dawn and dusk movement from what you've seen around the full moon instead of the new moon?
No, even though the time frames are similar, like I said, the spike in movement is coming because they're coming into heat. See, the shortening of the days, starts bringing them toward the rutting season. And then during that particular month, when the new moon comes, there's a sudden absence of any moonlight at night. Well, this lack of light affects the pituitary gland. And then the chasing accelerates their metabolism and they come into heat. Okay. And it's always during the new moon. Now, I have seen deer breed, here and there, you know, a doe will come into heat outside of that time frame. But over the years that I've hunted, all of the chasing and heavy breeding goes on during that week, and it goes on all day long. So it makes an ideal day to sit all day. And I have sat all day a lot of times, like on this buck that I just found, you know, just got the picture of. I'm not going to try for him in the morning, and I'm not going to try for him at night. I'm going to go in and set from like 10 till 3, and then I'm out of there because that's the peak movement period. I don't want to go in the morning and jumping out of the area, and I don't want to run into him walking out at night. So I'll just go in at, you know, 10 o'clock and leave at 3, no problem. Target just a particular hour. Now, I have done it to where I've hunted over here in the morning, moved to here at midday, took a small break, and hunted over here at night. So you can mix it up, you know, especially if you're on stand and the wind starts playing games. I don't stay there. I'll just move to a stand where that'll work, and I'm back off to the races.
Pike, I've got to ask you, just because, again, out of me and Andrew and you, you definitely have, you know, more of an understanding over, you know, not only just what we discussed, but just kind of like what you've, you know, learned for yourself, kind of, you know, tracking and following the moon. What specific questions do you kind of have or any kind of thoughts here? Because I know we have a ton to talk about on the outro, just kind of overall, you know, thoughts and kind of understanding of everything. But what are some of your, you know, again, points or anything that we want to discuss while kind of having Bill on here and kind of get his take? Because, again, I want to ask you a lot of other questions specifically when we get to the outro as well.
That's tough. That's there's so much to break down with this stuff. So, in your opinion, you like the new moon and you like the midday and then the dawn and dusk. Dawn and dusk being when you're going to be focusing on those open breaks to catch those bucks up on their feet, maybe a little sooner in the evening and a little bit later in the morning, going back to their beds. And then kind of focusing on that midday movement during the full moon and new moon in their bedding area. Is that right so far?
Yes, sir. That's really close. Yep.
So is there anything else in your opinion that you would focus on, you know, that you'd base your hunting strategy around besides those points right there?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's like, I have 28 different movement forces that I have that I check. You know, the one thing about, you know, what I try to do is I try to save hunters time on stand. But I also, you know, when you think about it, all this research, your camera research and all that, that can be done at home in your spare time in your office. So, you know, you're not milking your family, you know, with research and all this and then going out and hunt. I think I've said this before. Other than the storm fronts that may pop in, I only hunt about 10 days a month. Because over the years, I've just learned if it's going to happen, it's going to happen during those 10 days. Now, if I have a perfect morning ambush, then I may do some morning hunting. But I'm not real big on morning hunting either, because it's hard to know where they're all at when you're walking in. And if you run them out, you know, the hunt's over before it even begins. So I have to have a perfect, you know, perfect spot for me to go in the, you know, the early morning.
Okay. So I've got a bunch of questions here that just popped up in my head and y'all help me remember all of them. Okay. At what time, one of the questions would be at what time is that cutoff where you expect them to already be past you and back to bed to where you're not focusing on those travel routes? So like, is that overhead? Is that like 5 a.m., 6 a.m., 7 a.m.? Is there a specific overhead where you notice that it really just cuts off and they're usually already back in bed in the morning?
Yeah, that's going on. For instance, there's 8 mornings a month, 2 weeks apart, where the moon times, the majors, will fall after 4 a.m. in the morning. These are the excellent mornings to get close to his bed, because when I enter, the moon's already telling me he's with the does feeding. He's not near his bed on those days. And I don't even try to be quiet. I just walk right in and get in my tree. My buddy Rick was saying, man, you sound like an elephant. I said, don't matter. He's nowhere around anyway. You know, so... the moon can tell you when they're down for entry, or when you're risking running into them. If say the moon time falls at say 5 o'clock, guys generally go in at 5 o'clock. They're taking a chance on walking into deer. So the moon can tell you when they're supposed to be down, and if they're supposed to be down, then you have a lot better chance of gaining your spot.
How much time do you give them if the moon is overhead at 3 a.m. versus 5 a.m., how much time are you giving on each side of that overhead for them to be up on their feet still and feeding?
Periods last about 2 to 2.5 hours. So at 4 o'clock, if it's moon time in the a.m., He should be detained till at least 6:30, which is a half hour before daylight here. And that means I've got a greater chance of catching him running late.
So if your overhead was at 6 a.m., do you expect him to be in the bedding area feeding, or do you expect him to be out in a crop field, say, you know, a little ways away?
Whenever the feeding time, overlaps with twilight in the morning, what he will do is he will browse his way back toward his bed. And you find a browse route. They're marked with rubs, usually in a little bit thicker bushes and stuff like that. And so when I can pinpoint a browse route, and they have them both morning and they have them in the evening. See, when the moon is, like, say, on the night of the full moon, it never gets dark on that night, because as the sun sets, the full moon comes up. That's what dampens the movement in the evening on the night of the full moon, or the day of the full moon. But he will travel on a direct route. These are what I call sucker trails. They'll have a lot of big tracks and runs going both ways on and back and forth, because he's traveling directly from his bed directly to his evening bedding and feeding area. And in the morning, the same thing. When he comes back, he's just moving directly to his bed. But on the days when moon time, for instance, a lot of times in the evening in the first quarter, you can catch him on a browse route heading toward his evening feeding area. And it's not too hard to figure out. The rubs will be on the bedding side of the trees and sprinkled through there. And the same in the morning, the rubs will be on the feeding side of the trees. So you can kind of pinpoint these browse routes through that. So on those nights, they won't move directly to their feeding area under the cover of darkness through open areas. And like I said, runs look really good, but they're not, because they're only used in the dark.
Right. And that's one thing, if I'm understanding this right, did you say that with the rising moon, like around that full moon, when it's rising right at dark, it's not a good time to hunt?
That would be a minor time frame, and majors are obviously better than minors, but a minor overlapping with twilight might not be a bad bet either, because okay, you have some gravitational pull. It just kind of depends on how pressured your deer are. Like I said, some big bucks will leave the feeding area every night and be to their bed well before daylight. And this goes on until the dark period, when they do come out during the day.
Mike, while you're thinking, because I know you have probably some more questions and thinking some more, I've got a question that just kind of popped in my mind, Bill. How does this change this, like, feed pattern and kind of their path of travel back to bed, whether you're in, say, ag country, where you're hunting maybe timber blocks in and around agriculture, versus if you're in, like, a big wood setting or in a setting where there's maybe not as much or very little agriculture, and it's much more kind of timber and logging activity?
Well, I do hunt areas with some ag, and with field hunting like that, you're going to be able to play the twilight period a lot better, I think. Like I said, when you're hunting in ridge country like that, and there's acorns absolutely everywhere, unless you have camera data that's telling you, yeah, he's coming here to feed on a regular basis, and that could be after dark, but then you want to look at that, because just because he's coming after dark on these 3 or 4 days doesn't mean he's not going to show up on the night of the first quarter in plenty of shooting light. So it affects when they get where they're going, and it affects when they leave their bed, how early or how late. And learning to master that on the calendar has helped me immensely. It's helped me just take a lot of the guesswork out of it, you know, and I'm going off solid information, you know. And once I've done that, then I pick my spot and I go in and make my play. And does it work every time? No, sir, it don't. but all it's got to do is work once or twice a year for me, and I'm happy.
Pike, I want to turn back to you for a second. I don't know if you've kind of thought any more of those specific questions, because, again, more and more as we kind of now get a second to kind of either brainstorm some of these questions or kind of think about them after having part of this conversation, it's kind of given me like a better idea of some things that are, you know, more curious for me to learn about, especially like, again, that path of travel and also how this plays a factor in like on the scouting side, especially in the season scouting, and you're trying to, you know, find some of this sign. Maybe you jump a buck out of his bed midday, how you kind of use some of this information build to your advantage. Potentially, if you kind of know once that where that buck is generally staying, if he has, you know, a couple of his beds in a specific area that he really likes, how to use what we're talking about today, you know, to your advantage for an ambush hunt instead of just hunting blind in the area where maybe you know there's some deer in the general area, some bucks in the general area, but you don't necessarily know of that specific buck and what his characteristics are. Because we all know, you know, each whitetail is a little bit different. And like you said, Bill, you know, some of them don't go, don't follow this train of thought or this understanding. You know, some bucks are outliers. And that's the one interesting thing when it comes to whitetails is there's no absolutes, but there's definitely things that you can do to, you know, give yourself a bigger advantage when you're targeting, especially mature whitetails.
All right, so I was hunting near ridges, and at the base of the ridge I was hunting, there was an apple tree. And I came in and put my stand up, and right before dark, I had a big buck come off the ridge, off his bed. He was down 150 yards from me, and he walked with the wind, tailwinded to that apple tree. And I said to myself, and that was on the first yellow star evening headed toward the first quarter. If he moved at that time, that early on the first night, now I've got three more nights to make my play. Well, I moved my stand down there and set up over the apple tree. The next afternoon, I tried to sneak in there, and he spotted me from the ridge, and he went over the ridge and was gone. And so I thought, huh, that's not going to work. So I developed this plan. I started coming in before daylight, and watching from my stand, the first 2 days, he didn't show up, and so I left at midday. On the third day, the night of the first quarter, on the day of the first quarter, I was in there before daylight, and I watched him come in and bed down. Now, he's watching that apple tree all day, obviously, because he already busted me once. But now this turns his eyes against him, because he's been watching that all day. There's been no disruptions. And on that particular night, he come down, and when he went to take a bite off an apple, I let him have it. So watching for evening movement on early in the yellow star days, he may very well repeat that movement in the next three evenings, and he's going to repeat it closer and closer to dark as you get up to the first quarter, if that makes any sense. So that's how I played that one, because I couldn't get in my ambush tree while he was there. So once again, I had to be there ahead of time, but I didn't set all day because I got in there in the morning. Those first 2 days, he didn't show back up. And so I left, you know, and then that third morning he showed up, like I said, and bedded down. And then I just sat still all day. And sure enough, he repeated it. He tailwinded to that apple tree and I shot him.
Bill, how close was that buck bedded to that apple tree? Just curious.
150 yards. He could see it easy. Could watch it all day. See, when, you know, it's just like a buck on a ridge point. He's bedded with wind over back. He's watching downwind. And if anything comes up behind him, he'll escape to where he's been watching all day. That's not taking a chance. And then he'll turn and go into the wind. Okay. If something comes up, you know, from the bottom, which is we're incorporating leeward bedding here. A lot of hunters, you know, the deer are bedded on the south side of the ridge with the north wind. And they want to enter with the wind in their face, but they're entering where the buck can probably see them. And they don't know it. And so the buck's not going to go that way at dark. they're trying to play thermals, you know, and everything else. And if you get sight busted going in, it's game over. That's why on that hunt, I will enter from the north side with a north wind, with the wind directly over my back, and shoot it in a straight line off a steep area, down a ravine, wherever I can find where I don't think the deer are coming up. Ideally, I want to shoot to the elevation line and to the top. Because if he's bedded on a ridge point with a north wind on the south side over there, soaking up the sun and what have you, and the wind switches to the south, he's going to come up to the top and go out on a point on the other side so he can bed with wind over back. So the top's good for me. Ideally, be able to shoot to the elevation line and the top. If it just means just being over the lip. But that's another tactic, you know, using the wind. But once again, I'm trying to catch him at movement time, deciding to come to the top. Which, if the wind's over back and he's out on a south point, if he wants to go into the wind at night, he's going to come up to the top to me.
So, quick question. We've talked about the dark of the moon and how you like to, you like to focus on those areas with the light breaks because it increases, I guess, the distance that they travel. On the flip side of that, if you have a light period, so the full moon is overhead at that natural crepuscular movement time, which would be like 6 p.m. or 5 p.m., do you find that they don't travel as far from the bed, so you might want to position yourself closer to the bed instead of in those light breaks?
Well, anytime the moon starts getting over half full and you have all that reflective light in the sky at night, it delays their movement because it's not getting dark. And then that day of the full moon, it never gets dark on that night. And so that's why I've not had good luck in the evenings. I wouldn't hunt an evening during the full moon unless I had solid camera data that told me, you know, that that's where I needed to be and what I needed to be doing.
Yeah. And that's kind of what I was getting at a little bit earlier when I asked a question about that time period, because what I've noticed is when that moon is big and bright, right at that last light, it almost seems to me like everything is completely quiet. It's almost like all of the insects, all of the animals know that they're, I don't know, it's just something weird that those deer do not get up and come to those fields. And I guess that's probably has a lot to do with it, is that amount of light. They, you know, I've heard a lot of people talk about, I guess, that moon rising and stuff right at last light or right at dark when you're hunting in the evening. I've never personally experienced that. I know Clay, he said the most deer he's ever seen in the field happened during that time period, I think last year. But I always find that everything is completely quiet. It's like there's no movement in the woods. There's no animals moving. And it's just a really odd experience if you've been out there and seen that.
Well, it could be that on those days, the moon was in apogee. And apogee is not near the pull power as perigee. So if the moon's in apogee, that dampens movement, you know. Rain can dampen movement or enhance it. It just depends on the temperature. All these variables, once you learn how to work them together, you can say, yeah, you know what? Tonight's going to be a good night. And sometimes that happens without the first quarter moon in the evening. As a matter of fact, the second set of yellow star days on my calendar comes with the moon being underfoot. So there's no moon out reflecting light. And you get clouds on that night, and that's why those yellow star evenings are good, is because there is no reflective light in the sky other than starlight. And starlight will delay them too. But once again, if you can get the clouds, you got a deadly evening. Cloud, it all hinges on that dominant rotating variable under those circumstances.
Does the moon affect weather patterns or the type of weather you get at a certain time, or is it perigee or apogee? Or
the moon does control weather to a point, but I'm not exactly sure how it does that. I've never really looked into that. The moon was part of God's order in the beginning. He put all these planets in place and set up an order. And, I prayed and asked him to show me his order. And I was blessed, I think, in the fact that he's given me an incredible amount of wisdom. If people are listening and they're not following this, real close, I will say that my book has lengthy explanations for a lot of this stuff. And you get the calendar out and look at it, and then you're reading out of the book, and then you can begin to see what I'm talking about a lot more clearly.
Bill, as we kind of start wrapping up here, where can people find your book? What's the name of it? And where can people find your moon calendar as well?
Taking Pressure Trophy Whitetails in Urban and Farmland Areas, 500-page book. It covers everything we talked about tonight and a bunch more. My moon calendar is 3, 4, and 5 months, if you got guys that are hunting in January and whatnot. And it charts everything that we talked about tonight. And it will take, that's why I tell the beginning listener to just look at the calendar and follow it. Also work on figuring it out in greater detail. Somebody can call me anytime they want to, and I'd be more than happy to explain my calendar to them and explain what I can to them and help them. They can give me particular scenarios of their hunting property, this, that, and the other, and I've been able to help a lot of guys that way. But you can get that at www.pressuredeerpro.com. If they want a fast calendar, they need to order the electric version, because I'm busy making paper calendars as fast as I can right now.
Yeah, perfect.
It might be a little bit longer wait for them if they want that. I also offer Zoom training. I recommend 5 lessons. They're 2 hours long. I get out the whiteboard and I do a lot of explanation. I'm doing very well with that. I'm glad I started it. And then I do have a few video series out there. Don't forget about my buddy Greg's Licking Branch Magic book and Property Management. Those, and then we do offer Ambush. I go to the properties and set them up for ambush. Or Greg and I go, and he manages, and I set up ambush points and things like that. Those are probably the gist of the services that we offer.
Absolutely, and a lot of that you can be found at pressuredeerpro.com.
And in the show notes.
And the show notes, yeah. Look down the show notes below. You'll have links to everything as well down there. So that's perfect. Well, Bill, we greatly appreciate you coming on the podcast. I know this is going to be the last time we've had you on. I know there's going to be other topics as well in the future to discuss. And, with listeners, kind of give us some feedback from this episode, kind of give us some other ideas for future content and future episodes with you guys. So, Bill, again, greatly appreciate you coming on the podcast. Michael, thank you for joining us as well this evening. And, Bill, do you have any kind of final thoughts before we completely wrap this up here?
Like I said, it may have sounded a little bit deep, but I'm telling you what, it's really simplistic. Once you learn these things and get them ingrained up here, it starts becoming automatic. And it does take some time to learn it, then to develop your own tactics for your own individual area, because in some areas they may not have as much trouble with nocturnal movement, but around here we do, and that's why I developed these tactics.
Absolutely. Well, Bill, we appreciate you joining us for the podcast. Thanks again for all the listeners joining us for this episode. Again, you can learn more hitting the links down in the show notes below and learn a little bit more about what Bill and his whole team has to offer in his website, along with the Moon Calendar and his book. And guys, we'll catch you back on this Friday's episode of the Southern Outdoorsman, where we break down this episode with Michael Pike in this week's outro. So thanks again for everybody listening, and we'll catch you back here on the next episode of the Southern Outdoorsman podcast.
All right, I'm going to tell y'all how I like to use one of my favorite tools out in the woods, and that is the tracker from Onyx Hunt. So here's how I've been using it lately. I got this new property I'm going to be hunting this year, and the very first thing I did on the property was I went out and I drove all of the roads that are drivable in my truck. And I had the tracker on as I was driving around. So after I got done driving around, I selected the track on my app and changed it to where it's just a solid black line. So now I've got a really nice, easy to see roadmap of everywhere that's drivable in a truck on the property. So here's what that does for me so far. Now I've got an easy to read map of everywhere that you can drive in a truck on the property. But also that roadmap is actually very useful because it makes it very easy for me to see what roads are drivable and what parts of the property are most accessible and what parts of the property are least accessible. Like I said, one of my favorite tools. If you're not using it already, you should be. And if you want to give Onyx a try, go get an Elite membership and use the promo code Southern at checkout. That's going to save you 20% and it's going to help the show out. Know where you stand with Onyx Hunt. If you hunt deer out of trees, you need to go check out latitudeoutdoors.com. They got a little something for everybody, whether you're a saddle guy or if you hunt out of a climber. Of course, Latitude makes some of our favorite saddles and climbing sticks, but they also make some great packs and backpack straps that you can attach to the bottom of a climbing tree stand to make it more comfortable to carry in the woods. Probably my favorite piece of gear I've gotten in the last several years is the Ranger 22 from Latitude. It's like a do-it-all backpack for me. It's compact, which I like, but it's adjustable enough that it gets me through the whole season. It's the only pack I use. I use it in early bow season when I'm not carrying much in the woods, all the way to late January rut hunts in the deep south when it's cold and I'm carrying all kinds of clothes and all kinds of stuff on my back. The Ranger 22 is adjustable enough that I can just use that one backpack all season. And hey, all you Mossy Oak Bottomland fans, they just released the Ranger 22 in Mossy Oak Bottomland. So like I said, no matter how you like to hunt, Latitude's got something for you. Go check them out at latitudeoutdoors.com.
Well, guys, meet your new favorite summer scouting optic. And no, it's never too early to start scouting for the fall. Introducing the Vortex Crossfire Spotting Scopes with three different models of how you glass. Me and Andrew have both used spotting scopes in the summer to go out and glass fresh, clear cuts that's got a little bit of growth on them to find basher groups actually feeding in the summer. It's a pretty fun time, and also it's a great opportunity to take your kids out, especially if you can sit in the truck while you're glassing. It's always one of those pieces of optics like to keep in the truck at all times because you never know when you might need it. Be sure to stop by your local Vortex dealer to get out the all-new Crossfire Spotting Scopes, or to get 10% off your favorite spotter, head over to eurooptic.com and enter code Southern10 at checkout to save 10% on your order.
You know, one reason that we named our company the Southern Outdoorsman is because we're not just southern deer hunters or southern turkey hunters. We kind of hunt everything: quail, doves, waterfowl, rabbits, squirrels, you name it. I know a lot of you guys are the same way, and our friends at Whitetail Hill are like that as well. Whether you've got a hunting club, a lease, or your own property, they've got a blend for pretty much every situation on a piece of ground. I mean, they've got a seed blend for everything. If you want warm season deer forage, check out Summer Bulk. If you need to screen off a plot or cover an access route, Hideaway grows up to 12 feet tall and is built for that exact purpose. You got a duck hole or a pond edge? Check out the waterfowl blend. You want to plant for doves or quail? Check out their dove and quail plot. If you need soil that needs a little bit of work before fall, check out Dirt Doctor. And of course, they got a full cool season lineup ready to go when fall planting time gets here. And if you're unsure about what to plant, go to whitetailhill.com. They've got a seed selection guide on there that'll help you pinpoint exactly what you need on your property. So y'all check them out today. That's Whitetail Hill. Go to whitetailhill.com.